Last week we read of Jesus' betrayal into the hands of the Sanhedrin. And Mark mentioned only two people involved, Jesus and Judas, in order to present the scene as a confrontation between the two. The armed crowd is there, to be sure, but the focus is not on them. Mark rivets attention to Judas, who at the beginning, we're told, is one of the 12, and by the end of that passage becomes the betrayer. The other disciples are not named, but we are told that they all abandon Jesus. In the subsequent scene before us today, we once again have many actors, but only two who are named. This time, the focus is upon Jesus and Peter. Like Judas, Peter was one of the 12. Unlike Judas, Peter was included in that inner core of three who were privileged to witness key events in the ministry of Jesus, like the raising of Jairus' daughter from the dead and Jesus' magnificent transfiguration. Peter often speaks up as the chief among the disciples, even taking it upon himself to rebuke Jesus and to reject his words of prophecy. Specifically, when Jesus predicted that all the disciples would fall away from him, Peter replied, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." When Jesus then says that Peter will deny him three times that very night, Peter counters, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." Peter did not suffer from a lack of self-confidence, at least on that occasion. But this before us today is a different occasion. Peter was among those who had fled at the arrest of Jesus, and now we encounter him after the arrest at the time of Jesus' trial before the Sanhedrin. And Mark interweaves the story of Peter and Jesus. He sets the stage for the story of Peter, then he breaks away to the story of Jesus, only to return at the end to Peter. Though presented sequentially, we are to understand that the two stories occur simultaneously. They have more in common than just a time frame. As Jesus undergoes a formal trial, Peter undergoes a trial as well. Like Jesus, he is interrogated, and like Jesus, he makes a statement of confession. Mark tells a tale of two trials that reveals much about the true identity of Jesus as well as the true identity of Peter. For our outline today, we'll have three points. First of all, we'll see the stage is set in verses 53 and 54, then scene 1, the trial of Jesus, in verses 55 through 65, and scene 2, the trial of Peter, in verses 66 through 72. The stage is set, scene 1, the trial of Jesus, scene 2, the trial of Peter. And we want to enter into this dramatic narrative, understanding that this is God's holy, inspired word for our edification. We begin with the stage being set in verses 53 and 54. Mark begins by setting the stage for the drama that will unfold, and we meet the main actors, and we get a sense of the scenery. Starting at 53, "And they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. But Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire." Jesus has been arrested by an official force sent by the Sanhedrin, and now he is brought to the high priest. The description of the building with the courtyard suggests that this is the residence of the high priest. The gathering of the chief priest, elders, and scribes constitutes a formal gathering of the Sanhedrin, which is sort of the Jewish religious supreme court. Now, we're somewhat surprised at the appearance of Peter in the narrative. We know that he fled when Jesus was arrested, but now we read Peter followed him at a distance. This is a revealing statement. In verses 51 to 52, we read of an unnamed young man who followed Jesus at the time of his arrest and only escaped when he slipped out of his garment and fled away naked. And we saw in his flight a statement about the utter abandonment of Jesus by all his followers. But now we learn that Peter also followed him, but not in the way that young man had done. The young man followed as in a way that identified him as a supporter of Jesus and thus brought danger of suspicion upon himself. He risked arrest. This is not how Peter followed. Peter followed at a distance. Jesus had appointed the 12 to be with him. And now Peter chooses to be with the servants, a term that could include both servants and also some of the guards that were there at that time. This is not a picture of a disciple in intimate communion with his master in an hour of need. No, Peter keeps a distance that dissociates him from Jesus. He has forsaken a discipleship of costly following for one of safe observation. And Peter's distance at this point foreshadows an increasing distancing of himself from Jesus as his story unfolds. But before Peter's story continues, we shift to focus on Jesus. And that brings us to our second point, scene one, the trial of Jesus. What is happening to Jesus? We pick up the text in verse 55. Now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and with 3 days I will build another made without hands.' But not even then did their testimony agree." The chief priest and the council, the word translated council, is actually in Greek the word Sanhedrin. This supreme judicial body of Judaism is engaged in a formal trial of Jesus. But it is a strange affair. On the one hand, we get the impression that everything is being done by the book. Witnesses must give credible testimony that would lead to judgment of the accused. But the basic rules of evidence, we're told, are not going to be tossed aside. At the same time, the sentence has already been decided in advance. For we're told they sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death. You see, they knew what they wanted to do. They wanted to put him to death. And so they just had to find some accusation, really any accusation might do, that would bring a guilty verdict and a death sentence. And this is in accord with what we already know of these men. When Jesus had cleansed the temple, we learn that the scribes and chief priests sought how they might destroy him. And earlier in this chapter, we read, the scribes and chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him. Now that Jesus has been arrested, he is being tried with the sole intent of finding grounds to kill him. While the charge had to be legitimate, it seems they didn't really care what it was, so long as it could lead to capital punishment. So a string of witnesses testifies. This was a legal requirement. We heard as part of our Old Testament reading this morning, Deuteronomy 19:15. One witness shall not arise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. While they attempt to follow the demands of the law, it doesn't work out the way they desire. The problem is that many bore false witness against him, and their testimonies did not agree. And we don't know the details of what all these witnesses said, but we do know that they gave conflicting testimony. And you know, even in our day, if there's conflicting testimony in a court of law, that testimony sort of falls away as useless. We're giving one example of what some testified. We read, then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands.'" Now, Mark has recorded Jesus' prophecy about the temple's destruction, but not in these words. Based on other gospel records, it appears the witnesses cobbled together quotations and misquotations of Jesus to put damning words in his mouth. They are making Jesus out to be a revolutionary intent on leading a personal crusade to destroy the temple. This is false witness. And it is not surprising that those who bear false witness don't agree in their testimony. That can be expected of people who make up their testimony as they go. Now the scene evokes Old Testament images. Psalm 27:12. False witnesses have arisen against me, and such as breathe out violence. Psalm 35:11, fierce witnesses rise up. They accuse me of things that I do not know. Jesus is the righteous man of the Psalms, suffering from the malicious accusations of false witnesses. Despite the appearance of following correct legal procedures, the trial is shown to be a charade at just this point. If false witnesses emerged in a trial, there was to be an investigation. A few verses after the requirement of two or three witnesses is given in Deuteronomy, we read, "The judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you." Once testimony arose that was conflicting, those conducting the trial had the obligation to determine whether this was intentional and malicious or perhaps just a matter of poor memory. If a witness intentionally lied, then he exposed himself to receive the same punishment he was seeking against the one whom he testified. In a capital case, a false witness could himself receive capital punishment. But we have no indication that any investigation to get to the bottom of conflicting testimony was made in this case. While a semblance of justice was maintained by not accepting such testimony as a basis for judgment, the false witnesses giving that testimony were not held accountable. The ball would keep rolling until some charge against Jesus arose that they could make stick. Continuing in verse 60, "And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, 'Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?' But he kept silent and answered nothing." So rather than rebuking the false witnesses, as he should have done, the high priest turns to interrogate Jesus. "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" And Jesus' silence reminds us that this righteous one is also the suffering servant of whom Isaiah wrote in prophecy. "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." Jesus' silence is not an admission of guilt. It is a sign of his innocence and his submission to fulfilling the role of a lamb that is to be slaughtered for the sins of his people. But his silence is broken in order to reveal his true identity. We continue in verse 61. "Again the high priest asked him, saying, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?' Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.'" So here's a very direct question from the high priest. "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Remember, the word Christ means Messiah, the anointed one whom the Jews were expecting to arise in fulfillment of prophecy. The Son of the Blessed would be the Son of God. And the pronoun "you" stands first in this sentence in its original Greek, which is a way to emphasize it. So it's really saying, "You are the Messiah, the Son of God, you." Now, from the high priest's point of view, the question was meant to provoke Jesus to blasphemy. From Jesus' point of view, the question was an invitation to proclaim who he truly was. Jesus responds in these two short Greek words, "ego eimi," which means "I am." Very significant words in Scripture. It was the Lord's statement of self-identification that he revealed to Moses in preparation for the mission in Egypt. In Exodus 3:14, we hear the Lord saying, "I am who I am." And he said, "Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you." Now, Jesus has already taken these words upon his lips in Mark's gospel in self-revelation to his disciples. After the feeding of the 5,000, when the disciples were in the storm-tossed boat upon the sea, Jesus walked to them upon the water and declared, "Take heart, I am. Do not be afraid." And Jesus now speaks these words in answer to the high priest's question, declaring himself to be the Messiah and the Son of God. And as I am, as one with God himself. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He goes on, declaring to the entire Sanhedrin, this group of Jewish religious leaders arrayed against him. And he says, you, and that's in the plural, you all will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And once more, Jesus dips back into Daniel 7 to take his favorite title on his lips. The Son of Man is the one who will rule over an everlasting kingdom, we're told in Daniel 7. So what Jesus is basically saying to the Sanhedrin, I am the Messiah. I am the Son of God. I am the Son of Man, whom you all will see exercising powerful judgment from the right hand of God. And ironically, the Sanhedrin and others would see this display of power in the destruction of the temple in less than 40 years. It would not take place as the false witnesses had said. Jesus was not about at that point to give a popular uprising to overthrow the temple. But it would take place as an act of Jesus, as the Son of Man, who had at that point ascended back to his Father's right hand, sending forth judgment on an apostate Jerusalem through the armies of Rome. Well, the high priest had heard enough. Verse 63, then the high priest tore his clothes and said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Now, when an Assyrian official blasphemously challenged the power of Yahweh, Eliakim, master of the palace, Shebna the scribe, and Joah the herald all tore their garments. When they reported blasphemy to King Hezekiah, he also tore his clothes. These are Old Testament background passages. So when the high priest tears his garment here, he is engaging in this ancient ritual reaction to blasphemy. Jesus himself has broken the impasse of the conflicting testimony of the false witnesses. He has provided grounds for a new charge. And the high priest says to the Sanhedrin, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? He understood what Jesus was claiming about his identity. And not believing it to be a true, he accused him of blasphemy. The others concur and condemned him to be deserving of death. Now the Sanhedrin could conduct a trial and make a ruling, but under Roman rule at the time, they could not carry out a sentence of capital punishment. Only the Romans could do that, which is why we'll later see them send Jesus to Pilate. Their judicial misdeed accomplished, the Sanhedrin now turned Jesus over to mistreatment. Verse 65, then some began to spit on him and to blindfold him and to beat him and to say to him, prophesy. And the officers struck him with the palms of their hands. The mockery now heaped upon Jesus echoes that prophesied of the suffering servant in Isaiah 50, verse 6. I gave my back to those who struck me, and my cheeks to those who plucked out the beard. I did not hide my face from shame and spitting. Sadly, this is not the last time we will be drawn back to this prophetic portrait. Jesus will suffer such mockery after the trial by Pilate, and again at his crucifixion. Here, they specifically mock Jesus' role as prophet, covering his face, striking him, jokingly calling out, prophesy. It's with such scorn that Mark ends this scene of the trial of Jesus before the Sanhedrin. But now, thirdly, we come to scene two, and that is the trial of Peter, beginning at verse 66. So we return to the story of Peter, finding him where we left him in verse 54, in the courtyard of the high priest. This scene mirrors the preceding one. As Jesus was asked three questions by the high priest, so Peter will receive a threefold interrogation. As Jesus' interrogation had to do with his identity, so Peter's interrogation will have to do with his identity, particularly his relationship with Jesus. And we see that in the very first accusation, verse 66. Now, as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You also were with Jesus of Nazareth." Now, Peter is described as being below in the courtyard, indicating that Jesus is being tried in some room above the courtyard. At the scene of Jesus' betrayal, the servant, probably the head servant of the high priest, had his ear cut off. Now, another servant of the high priest appears, this one of much lesser rank, a mere servant girl. She sees Peter warming himself by the fire with the guards and says directly to him, "You also were with Jesus of Nazareth." It may sound like a casual observation, but in this context of hostility toward Jesus and the attempted arrest of one following him, it was an accusation. So how will Peter respond? We know how he said he would respond, right? "I will not deny you." Verse 68. But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you are saying." And he went out on the porch, and a rooster crowed. Peter meets her accusation with a denial. It is somewhat indirect as he claims not even to know what she's talking about. But claiming not to know about Jesus is a denial that he had been with Jesus. We read that he went out on the porch. Perhaps he's trying to avoid this embarrassing encounter going any further. But this one who followed Jesus at a distance is now putting further distance between Jesus and himself, both by his physical distance and by his words. When we read that a rooster crowed, we instantly recall what Jesus said to Peter before they went to Gethsemane. "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." Now a rooster has crowed immediately after Peter has denied Jesus. This is the first crowing. It is the first denial, but it will not be the last of either. Verse 69, "And the servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, 'This is one of them,' but he denied it again." Peter's move to the porch has not gotten him away from that pesky servant girl. She sees him again, and this time makes an accusation about Peter to some bystanders, not just speaking to Peter, but speaking to others, saying, "This is one of them." And Peter's response is similar to his first. Mark simply tells us, "But he denied it again." This verb deny is in a tense that suggests ongoing action. We might say that Peter denied it up and down. Thus far, the rooster has crowed once, and Peter has denied Jesus twice. And the narrative continues, verse 70 continues. "And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter again, 'Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean and your speech shows it.' Then he began to curse and swear, 'I do not know this man of whom you speak.'" Some time passes, and then the bystanders accused Peter to his face, "Surely you're one of them, for you are a Galilean." Perhaps Peter uses a Galilean dialect that gives away his origin. Perhaps it's that northern accent that they recognize. To the bystanders, a link with Galilee supports the servant girl's charge that Peter has been among those who had come from Galilee with Jesus. And Peter gives his most emotional denial in response to this allegation. The language here can refer either to cursing as profane speech, or taking an oath involving a curse against himself as if he is lying. In either case, Peter is crystal clear. "I do not know this man of whom you speak." Notice he doesn't even use Jesus' name. Perhaps that would have exacerbated his growing sense of guilt. He refers only to this man. Verse 72. "A second time the rooster crowed. Then Peter called to mind the word that Jesus had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times.' And when he thought about it, he wept. Immediately after that third denial, the rooster crows for that second time, and Peter remembers Jesus' prediction. It was the prediction Peter had rejected as false, essentially claiming Jesus to be a liar, as he boldly declared, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." Now, proud, self-confident, arrogant Peter is broken. His third denial has further increased his distance from Jesus, a fact he recognizes when the rooster crows for that second time. All that Jesus had said has come true. Peter is filled with remorse. He breaks down and he weeps. And that's how Mark's interwoven of two trials comes to an end. In the trial of Jesus, false witnesses arise but are unsuccessful in lodging a charge against him. Jesus is ultimately in control of the situation, openly confessing his identity in a way that gives grounds for the charge of blasphemy by any who would refuse to believe him. If Jesus is lying, then they are right to charge him with blasphemy. He's making himself out to be God. But if he speaks the truth, then of course they have no right to judge him. Ironically, those who sit in judgment on Jesus will one day experience judgment by him in his role as the Son of Man. In the trial of Peter, it is Peter who is the false witness. As Jesus is revealing his true identity, Peter is denying his true identity as a disciple of Jesus. As Jesus submits to scorn, Peter tries to escape it. Ironically, as Jesus is mocked with cries of prophesy, his prophecy about Peter is being fulfilled. Jesus is the true prophet. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is the Son of Man. Jesus is the suffering servant. Peter, on the other hand, is the failed disciple who increases his distance from Jesus until he realizes what he has done and breaks down in remorse. And don't we do this sometimes? When we feel guilt over our sin, we try to run from Jesus instead of to him. We tell ourselves that he can't accept us now, or we don't deserve to come into his presence. But we find out that when we distance ourselves from Jesus, we only make things worse. But we have reason for hope, even in such situations. Peter is only named one more time after this in Mark's gospel. After Jesus' resurrection, when the ladies come to the empty tomb, a young man in white robes tells them he is risen and then says, "Go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him as he said to you." His disciples and Peter. Now, Peter was one of the disciples. He could have just said the disciples. But how glorious it is that Peter is singled out by name. The last we see of him before this is at the end of our passage today, weeping in remorse. The threefold denier of Jesus, the failed disciple. But that is not the end of his story. The same Jesus who predicted Peter's three denials also predicted that after being raised from the dead, he would go before his disciples to meet them in Galilee. He would meet Peter in Galilee. And that prophecy would come true just as the others had. And what we need to see here, brothers and sisters, is the restoring grace of Jesus. So full will be his restoring grace that Peter is going to become a pillar in the church who will pour out his life unto death for his master who never denied him. May you be animated by the grace of Jesus, confessing and bearing witness that he is who he said he was, the Messiah, the Son of Man, the Son of God, the suffering servant, the true prophet, and your Savior and Lord. If you have come to place your faith in him and your faith in the power of his saving death upon the cross. If you have done that, then may you have confidence in the restoring grace of the one who will not deny his own. For just as he would not deny Peter, he will not deny you. Let us pray.